This is Rusty Gaffney, the Prince of Pinot, and this is Pinophile Live. We're featuring today the issue about World of Pinot Noir, dated March 23rd, 2008, Volume 6, Issue 56, titled Prince's Excellent Adventure at World of Pinot Noir. Today, I'm lucky to have a guest. Jay Selman, Mr. Grape Radio, has agreed to sit in and chat about the World of Pinot Noir. We spent some time together there, and welcome, Jay.
Thanks very much. It's a strange feeling being interviewed by somebody else. and let's be honest, you bribed me with some wine here.
Yeah, actually, we're having a little wine. One of the themes of this year's World of Pinot Noir was truly the world of Pinot Noir, and they actually had producers from practically every corner of the earth, including British Columbia, mm-hmm. Chile, Burgundy, of course, Germany, Italy, New Zealand, Switzerland, and Tasmania. And this wine we're sipping is from Central Otago in New Zealand.
And you're going to New Zealand pretty soon.
Next week, I'm heading out, and I'm going to check it out in person. And we're excited. Bless their hearts. Some of these foreign producers, I really admire them for their efforts. But to be honest with you, some of them are only for the adventurous. The tastes are not like we're used to here in California and Oregon.
Well, is that a reflection of where they are in their winemaking, or is it a reflection of just the climate, soils, etc.?
I don't think it's the winemaking. I think they certainly are there as far as winemaking skill, but it's the terroir, it's the location. Pinot Noir just doesn't do that well unless it's in a special environment.
Well, then you're suggesting that these other places, quite frankly, aren't appropriate for Pinot Noir.
You could say that.
Okay.
You could say that based on, wines that I've had. One of the problems is that here in the States, some of the best examples of Pinot Noir from other countries, for example, Germany and Italy and so forth, never reach our shores. So we never get a chance to really try the best stuff because it's snapped up by local people. Mm-hmm. It's made in small quantities. And even some of the best wines from New Zealand, we don't ever get to try here because they're not exported.
Okay, so that might explain some of it. But I wonder if part of it is just your palate is wired one way and these wines are built a different way. It doesn't necessarily mean they're not well-made wines or very good wines for that matter.
I agree completely. I think, we have a tainted palate, if you will, in the sense that we're used to a certain style of wine. And particularly in California, we're kind of spoiled by all this flashy fruit.
That's true.
And a lot of these wines that we taste from elsewhere are a little more rustic, restrained, austere. Mm-hmm. And so they have a lot of fans in their country, but not as many fans here. But nevertheless, it's a great experience to get to sample these wines from all over the world, and that's what made this event extra special.
Do these producers in Chile and Germany, so on and so forth, is their role model Burgundy or California or somewhere in between?
Well, a lot of the winemakers are from California. For example, in Chile, most of the major producers have consultant winemakers from California. So there is some California influence there. There's a lot of California winemakers in down under as well in New Zealand and Australia. So there's definitely some influence there. Probably the European Pinot Noirs are more influenced by Burgundy, like Switzerland, Germany, mm-hmm. which is understandable.
I've had the most satisfaction, I would say, New Zealand would come to mind.
Yeah, yeah.
Of all the ones you mentioned. Yeah.
Did you get a chance to sample the Quail's Gate Pinots from British Columbia?
I did.
I really thought those were outstanding wines. I think it's a shame that we can't get British Columbia wines here in California. there's a lot of people that think this is the next great region for Pinot Noir, actually.
Interesting.
Yeah.
It's funny that you mentioned that because in all honesty, and I don't like to admit this, but I came to the table almost with an expectation not liking, expecting not to like it. I wonder if that's, I don't know. I don't know why I went like that, but just maybe this the way I thought of it. So I wonder if that kind of influences, I ended up liking it a lot, but I wonder if sometimes our preconception influences what our final perception is.
For sure, yeah. And that's always a criticism of tasting wine when it's not blind, is that you have preconceived notions when you start out.
Yeah. Yeah, and I always thought of that when you talk about the wine in terms of the label, but this was I was basically dismissing a whole region, a wine-growing region we can't make Vino there. I've never even heard of Vino bean, you know.
Yeah.
So that's interesting.
Yeah, and you know what was fun, Jay, and I know you were involved in this, was interviewing these people and the winemaker from Quail's Gate. It was funny. We were trying to get him interviewed for a video program we were doing on this event through Grape Radio. And he had a couple really, really fine women at his booth.
Oh, great. That was really politically correct, Rusty. Thanks.
And we were standing there, you know, with our feet, tapping our feet, waiting. It seemed like an eternity. And you couldn't blame them, you know. I mean, so finally we were able to break them away and interview them. And it was a delightful interview. And that's part of the fun of these events is meeting people like this that have so much interest to offer. And some of them really come alive in the video format.
Yeah, in a way, I feel kind of sorry for these guys. For those of you that have never been to an event like this, it can be quite intimidating in a way because it's very frantic pace. And these guys behind the table are pouring wines as fast as they can, and people are shoving more stems than I want. And they will also want to talk to the person at the table. So it's crowded, it's noisy, and all those things. Now, mind you, I love that, but it can be a little bit intimidating for somebody.
Yeah, and people should remember when they go to these events is not to be intimidated.
Exactly.
Because wine people are really friendly by nature. They wouldn't be in the wine business if they weren't. And sometimes they get a little bogged down with the same questions over and over again or distracted because of so many people, like you say. But you should never be reluctant to approach them and talk to them and ask them questions because for the most part, they're more than happy to spend some time with you.
I could not agree more. I think overriding, if you look around you when you see that and you see everybody's having fun, they're laughing, they're enjoying themselves, it just adds to the whole ambiance of the thing. And it is tough in some ways to go and ask that first question, but you just got to feel comfortable. And no, there's no stupid questions and all that kind of stuff. You just go ahead and just ask what you want to do or ask what you want to ask and have fun with it.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're right.
One of the sessions that we went to together, Jay, was the Burgundy tasting. Each year at World of Pinot Noir, they feature a well-known domain and they bring the owner or winemaker over. And this year it was Domaine Jacques Frédéric Meunier. And Alan Meadows, the so-called Berg Hound, who has a wonderful newsletter, if you want to call it, or quarterly publication on Burgundy, and certainly is the world's authority on, or at least one of the world's authorities on Burgundy, conducts this session. And he really gets into this. I mean, this is one of the highlights of his year. And he has a real knack for bringing out the best in these wine personalities because the French that he brings over, the Burgundians, are a little bit shy.
Sure.
They're not used to this kind of glamorous setting and being fawned over, maybe. And so it's a little bit of a challenge for him. I think he does a good job.
I think he does a terrific job. The difference, at least the way I look at Alan Meadows, is this is more than just a gig for him, a job. He absolutely loves it. I mean, through every fiber of his being, you can tell that. People use the word passionate in wine a lot, but you could just tell this guy he's passionate. He just loves this stuff. And I think that puts the producer at ease a little bit. They can see that they really, you know, he cares about it. And, of course, the attendees care about it. The other thing about attendees to keep in mind, Rusty, and I don't know how they get around it, is the language barrier. Mm-hmm. That's going to be hard for them. I mean, they've done pretty well for themselves, and but it's awkward. Think about if you were had to speak in front of 200 people mm-hmm. in a foreign language.
Right. I mean, and, you know, you have all this complicated wine lexicon, all wine terminology, which are different in French and English and so forth. So, you know, I have to admire them for that. But the thing I like about these sessions is that I always pick up a few little pearls from mm-hmm. Alan Meadows, things that just don't show up in print. For example, he was talking about all the most recent vintages in Burgundy, talking about the differences between those vintages. Mm-hmm. And I find that really helpful because in Burgundy, vintage is much more important than it is here in California. And the vintages vary more in Burgundy, and each vintage offers certain type of tasting experiences that may appeal to one person and not another person and so forth. But the one thing that really came out to me was how he pointed out that the 2001 vintage was never really that highly touted, and yet this is a vintage he's always admired and enjoyed. And we were drinking a couple of Meunier Pinot Noirs from 2001, and you were just beginning to see these wines blossom. They were just starting mm-hmm. to show their beauty, and he pointed this out, and it was evident to me, comparing the 01s versus the more recent vintages that were also poured like 03, 04.
Yeah, In my case, I pick up more than a few nuggets, but I'm a little bit lower down on the scale than you are in terms of knowledge. And he also does a good job of not only articulating the differences of vintage, but also of terroir. And he mm-hmm. describes that in detail that I can understand. And more important to me is that I could actually perceive. My palate has the ability to – he described in such a way that I could actually use my senses to perceive mm-hmm. what he's talking mm-hmm. about. And I remember you and I actually getting back to the vintage thing, kind of we kept on looking at each other when we got to the 2001, you know, yeah. just shaking our heads just like kind of what we're doing now. Yeah. And you could actually to experience that is something that is very valuable to me. It's not something just intellectual that you might hear. You actually experience it. You understand mm-hmm. it at some level within yourself. Yeah, that's very valuable. Matter of fact, if you want to know the truth, it was so valuable to me that I went out afterwards and I said, yeah, this is enough for me. I'm going to go back and maybe I need some more 2001s.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
there's some buys out there because yeah. everybody's focused on the right. you know 2005s and right. such. So I went out there. It kind of reminds me of a 93, which I think was somewhat of a dismissed vintage to mm-hmm. some extent. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I've gone out there and found some great mm-hmm. value, great buys. I've been very happy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you think we sometimes get overly obsessive on a vintage? And I think Alan actually touched on it, if I remember correctly. Sometimes we just focus in.
Yeah, these are generalizations.
Yeah.
When it comes to Burgundy, I think you have to pay attention to the vintage, though.
Yeah.
But the second thing that's really important is the producer. Mm. Because you have to understand, a lot of the vineyards in Burgundy are owned by multiple people.
Right.
Each one may own two or three rows. So there may be five, six producers from one vineyard.
Right.
So the name of the vineyard doesn't guarantee quality.
Right.
But the producer does.
Right.
So that's what you have to look for. And Meunier is an extremely highly respected producer. I was taken when Alan Meadows said that he felt that his wines showed the most purity of any producer in Burgundy, except D'Angerville.
Right.
That's saying something coming from Alan. And he pointed out that the thing about Meunier's wines is that they're pure because Freddie, and they call him Freddie Meunier rather than Frederic, it's not what he does to make the wines, it's what he doesn't do. Mm. He's a hands-off guy. He lets the vintage, the wine, take over. And Alan admitted, you know, if I was in a winemaker, there's no way I could keep my hands off things that way. And so he admired him for this. And so this is one of the admirable features of Meunier wines. And, you know, Jay, I looked on the internet at prices, and some of his lower-level wines are not that bad. The Chambol Moussigny, which is a village wine, actually contains quite a bit of Premier Cru grapes,
right.
Alan pointed out. And you're talking $50 to $60.
Right.
And a couple of his other wines are just a little more. Now, of course, once you get into Beaumar or Moussigny, then, you know, you're talking big bucks. But those vineyards are exceptional.
I have a Magnum of his. So.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I knew
you'd want to. The 1990. Well, you know, I collect 1990. I think it would be useful to describe, at least from your mind, what you mean by purity.
I guess it would mean unadulterated by any excessive intrusion of oak, for example, manipulation through any color additives or enzyme additives. Somehow the wine exhibits only the expression of the grape.
Right.
But, you know, to really put this into words is not that easy.
For me, it means some degree of transparency. Mm-hmm. There's almost a direct relationship to the fruit and the vineyard. There's no distractions
right.
to it. A great delineation of the fruit itself. There's the fruit there without being, like you said, adulterated or somehow manipulated in some way.
Yeah.
And it's more, maybe it is something you can't quite articulate. Maybe it's something you've got to experience it. But when you experience it, you know it.
That's the whole thing. You know, the thing with Pinot Noir is that when you taste purity or you taste these sensations, they really can't be described. It's a visceral. It's a feeling that comes from your heart, so to speak. You can't put it into words sometimes. So what'd you think of the Moussigny?
Actually, I keep thinking about, I kept glancing over to the right where they had all the bottles there that they had opened for the tasting. And I go, oh, I've never seen that many of these bottles. It was just amazing to see that. Well, definitely the 2001 for me as a vintage was just terrific. Yeah. And actually, the wines were quite different than anything I've had before. I'm not sure if I could really articulate what it was, but maybe it was this purity, but there was something that I could immediately relate to, I mean, in the wine itself, something I could connect with in some way. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that makes any sense. I can tell you this, that the thing that definitely struck out for me was balance.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. Impeccable.
Yeah.
Beautiful. It's interesting because Meunier didn't start out as a winemaker. He was a pilot, an engineer by trade. And he admits that when he started making wine from his family's properties, he didn't know squat about winemaking. And actually what he said was that over the years, he's taken classes in Beaune and the basics, but really it's experience has served him the best.
You should share what he said about the concept of terroir. I thought it was fascinating.
Fill me in.
It was almost, here's my impression. I can't say, I don't want to put words into his mouth, but I got the impression that he's, well, maybe he's kind of saying, I'm not sure I'm quite sold on this in all cases. Not, it doesn't exist per se, but maybe it's a bit overstated sometimes.
Uh-huh.
That's the impression I got, just the way he was talking about it.
Yeah.
Very, by the way, very approachable, sort of affable, you know?
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. I mean, there was no airs or arrogance about him at all. Absolutely none.
And we were lucky enough to have lunch with him afterwards,
him
and Alan and his wife. I mean, it was terrific.
Right. It really was. Well, it was a fun time, Jay. And this is one of the top Pinot Noir festivals held in California and Oregon, and I look forward to going to it every year. And
I don't want to sound like a show for the event, but it really there's no excuse not to go to that if you love Pinot Noir.
Yeah,
if you love it, you got to be there.
Yeah,
and not only just like you touched on before, not only just for the wine, but for the people that you get to meet and talk to. And by the way, you didn't touch on this, but they had a nice spread of food there too.
And good food.
Oh my God. Absolutely. You know, I mean, yeah. We're talking like, we're not talking the Ralph's cheese kind of thing. Right. I mean, they had Carmel Cheese Shop, they had a piece of lamb, you know. Mm-hmm. Man, that was good.
And they also had a seminar on food and wine.
Yeah,
Sommelier's Challenge.
And, exactly.
And we've talked about this a lot together, that sometimes food gets pushed into the background, and really they go together hand in hand, because really wine is food, and it's enjoyed best with food. And so the food aspect of these events is always enjoyable, because mm-hmm. they do make an attempt to bring it out. Right. Appropriately with wine.
Yep.
And Pinot Noir is a food wine.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
So, I mean, you can't have one without the other.
No argument here.
Well, listen, thanks, Jay, for sitting in today. I enjoyed your comments, and it was a pleasure.
Well, thanks for the wine.